Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you with us on Wisconsin Public Radio, and it's time to talk about native plants with our guest, Neil DeBoll, back with us once again. He's president of Prairie Nursery, co-author of The Gardener's Guide to Prairie Plants, and really recognized internationally as an expert in native plant community ecology. So we'll talk with Neil about what and when to plant native seeds and transplants. And of course, we'll take your questions as we move along. What would you like to know about fall sowing? Are you looking for advice on getting rid of weeds in your prairie garden? Maybe you have another native plant question. Join in. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Neil DeBoll, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Great to be on, Larry. Thanks so much. As the fall season is upon us a little early here.
It is indeed. Are you folks busy?
No, we're just sitting around waiting for the phone to ring. We're super busy. We're getting our plant orders together. And next Monday is our first week of fall plant shipping, which goes on for 5 weeks into early October. And it is all hands on deck. Let's go.
Well, you know, it's a busy time, and fall can be a great time to sow wildflower seeds.
Indeed. It's a good time to sow wildflower seeds, and it's a good time to plant a lot of our native plants so they can get a head start on the next spring by developing their roots in the fall, and then they're out of the ground ahead of the game in the next spring. So, but yeah, one of the real good reasons to sow, especially wildflower seeds in the fall, is that many of these native flowers, not the grasses so much, but the flowers, require exposure to cold, damp conditions in the soil to break seed dormancy, resulting in significantly higher germination for many species in the following spring compared to planting them in April, May, or June without this treatment. So it's kind of a preventative measure. So let's say I'm a prairie seed and it's, you know, middle of September. I fall on the ground and it rains and maybe it's a little bit warmer than it is now. And I germinate. Well, come November, I'm out of the gene pool, baby. So... Now, interestingly, there are some species that their life strategy is to germinate late August and September, and they will overwinter, and they get a head start, and it really works. Like black-eyed Susan will do this. Sometimes spiderworts will do this. So lupine seeds will germinate in August, early September, and they'll develop their roots, and they're able to overwinter. But the vast majority of seeds that are produced by prairie plants in the summer, the fall, whatever, they will sit in the soil over the winter, and that cold, damp conditions will trigger them to know, okay, when the soil warms up, winter's over, it's safe to germinate now. So it's a really interesting process. Unfortunately, this does not work for the warm season prairie grasses like little blue stem, big blue stem, Indian grass, side oats grandma. We see significantly lower germination of the grasses when seeded in the fall. They are generally better planted in May and June when the soil is warm, the warm season grasses. There are cool season prairie grasses like Canada wild rye and Virginia wild rye, which if you plant them now, they'll typically germinate, like the lupine and the black-eyed Susan. That's their cycle. They'll germinate pretty much any time, those two species. But anyway, so you have some variations between the different species, especially the warm season grasses and the flowers, as far as what will happen if you plant in the fall. But if your goal is to have a really floriferous prairie and you have a seed mix, plant it in the fall and you'll get a higher ratio of flowers to grasses pretty much for the length of that prairie and for decades. So I can take the same exact seed mix, the same exact soil side by side, same exact site preparation, plant half of that mix in the fall, half of the mix in the spring, and I'll have two different prairies, one that has more flowers with the fall planted mix and one with a higher grass to flower ratio with the early spring or with the spring or summer planting. It's really amazing.
Yeah. And you mentioned site preparation. How about preparing the soil when you're ready to sow?
Well, it's so important that you have all the existing perennial vegetation completely eliminated before you sow your seeds. If you do not, let's just say there's a little one-inch piece of quack grass remaining. And I know just about everybody out there has gone mano a mano with quack grass, which creeps by rhizomes. You can leave even a half-inch section of rhizome, and it will grow. And quackgrass has been shown to be able to spread up to 3 feet in one direction in one growing season by rhizomes. Yeah. Okay. Oh. It's a super competitor. It's also allelopathic. Allelopathic meaning that it uses chemical warfare, exudates from its roots to depress or prevent the germination of other species. So it uses chemical warfare against other plants. This is not uncommon. There are a lot of plants that will do this. Something like black walnut is a great example. Okay.
Well,
so, yeah. I'm sorry.
Keep going.
Okay, I mean, site preparation. You know, site preparation is to a prairie like your foundation is to a house. You can put a $10 million house on a lousy foundation, and the whole doggone thing will fall down. Same thing here. If you don't get the weeds, the perennial weeds out of there, perennial grasses, perennial weeds, and that can include grapevines and buckthorn and all this stuff. If you don't get all that stuff out of there and make sure it's completely gone, you will be fighting a rearguard battle for the entire life of that prairie, and it will not be a fun process. So site preparation is super critical. Yes, there will always be weed seeds, and there will be annual weeds and biennial weeds, but it's the perennials that you really need to control because those are going to be the long-term competitors that you must vanquish ahead of time.
So what's the best approach to vanquishing those predators?
the predator weeds. Well, that depends on your preferences. There are a number of different ways to do this. On small areas, whether you're going to put in a garden with transplants or a small seed mix, you can smother it. And you don't have to use black plastic to smother. Some people try to solarize with clear plastic. We've had variable results here in Wisconsin for whatever reason. It just seems to like make a nice little greenhouse for weeds to come up in. Now, here in Texas or Oklahoma or Mississippi, it seems to work pretty well. But we just don't seem to be able to get the temperatures to kill the weeds. Maybe some people have had better results, or maybe we're just not doing it right, but it hasn't worked nearly as well. But you can use old carpets. You can use a couple layers of cardboard. A lot of people will use the lasagna method, where you put down cardboard and then you put compost or other organic material. Be careful. Don't use a lot of wood chips because they have a high carbon-nitrogen ratio, and they will rob the soil of nitrogen and make your plant growth much slower. But you can put leaves. I use a lot of leaves for composting. So you can put down cardboard a couple layers and then put a bunch of leaves over it in the fall and leave it there for one full growing season. And then by the next fall, you're ready to put down your seeds or your plants. Now, on larger areas, if you don't want to use any chemicals, any herbicides, you can use soil tillage, where you go out approximately every 4 to 5 weeks and just rip up the ground about 6 inches to rip up all the weeds. And you do that monthly, approximately, for the entire growing season, and that will kill practically all weeds except deep tap-rooted weeds like Canada thistle, which has root, which I'm sure, yeah, you're laughing, Larry. Yeah, it has roots that can go 2 feet deep and lateral rhizomes, so it's really hard to get rid of. You need a backhoe if you're going to do it organically. Or you can smother it for like 3 years. Really, I'm not kidding. It is resistant to smothering. Any rate, or you can use herbicides. Many people will use glyphosate, i.e. Roundup. It's effective. It's relatively cost effective. It's easier than all this constant tilling. And on a hillside, you can't till the soil because you'll cause soil erosion. So you have to be very careful and strategic about what method you select so you make sure you're not creating an environmental disaster, even if you're not using herbicides or anything. Not that herbicides necessarily create an environmental disaster, depending on the ones you use. There are only certain herbicides that I will use. I'm quite selective about that. But so those are your basic methods. One other method is smother crops on a larger area. You can put down buckwheat. You can plant buckwheat after the danger of all frost has passed, usually around mid-June. It grows for a couple of months, and it flowers, and it creates a really dense cover. This is what farmers used to use for controlling mostly quackgrass and other weeds. They would smother it out, and they would get a saleable crop, which is why we all ate buckwheat pancakes 125 years ago, because it was so cheap. But then you follow that with winter wheat or winter rye, which you would plant in usually early September. What you do is you cut down the buckwheat before it goes to seed.
Yes.
Because if it goes to seed, you're going to have cover crop forever. Okay, you know. It sounds like the voice of experience there, Mr. Mueller.
Not me, but I know someone else who had that issue.
Yes. So as soon as they're done flowering, you know, bees love buckwheat. Oh, my God, they go crazy. It makes like honey that's almost like molasses. It's really a dark honey, so it's not everybody's favorite type of honey. But then you cut it down before it goes to seed, and then you till it in. Now you're doing green manuring, adding organic matter to the soil, and the root, it's a taproot, so it helps to break up clay soils. So it's really handy if you have a heavy soil. Then you let it sit for a couple of weeks, so that, any ammonia or any breakdown products from the green cut material doesn't cause any problems for your next crop, which would be the winter wheat or winter rye. And then you grow that over the winter, and then when that's starting to head out, usually in June, you cut it down, till it in, more organic matter, green manure going in the soil, and plant another crop of buckwheat. And then by fall, you should be pretty much weed-free, and you use no chemicals. You didn't have to till the soil every month. So it's a really good way to go. And you can plant buckwheat at 60 to 70 pounds per acre, usually in early to mid-June. And then you plant your winter wheat or winter rye around 100 pounds per acre in early September.
There you go.
It's a really good method, and it will improve even having clay soils. You'll be amazed in just a two-year cycle. It's actually a one-year cycle. Well, one and a half. How much organic matter you can actually add to a clay soil and break that clay soil up and give it better tilth, better workability.
Mary in Cross Plains has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Mary.
Hi there. I think I have two questions. The first one is I have a lovely new wildflower garden, small one, and this is the first season, and it's beautiful. Just wondering what I can do to maintain that and prevent weeds coming for future seasons. And also, should I reseed this fall, or is what's there going to reseed itself?
Okay, I have a couple questions for you, Mary. So when you say it's a wildflower garden, normally when we refer to a wildflower garden, that is a planting that we installed with transplants, whereas a wildflower meadow would be established with seeds. Did you use seeds or plants on this?
It's a meadow, yes.
Okay, so you use seeds, no plants, right?
Yes.
Okay, and this is the first year and it looks great?
Yes, we had to have a new well put in and there was just nothing there, you know.
Sure.
Went into like just a beautiful black dirt that had no weeds or any grasses growing in it.
Okay. So it sounds to me as though you have what we would call a commercial wildflower mix, which typically has a lot of annuals in it, and which makes it look really great. And here's the difference between a commercial, for lack of a better term, wildflower mix. I call them hardware store mixes, but whatever. As opposed to a native perennial prairie mix. And since prairie wildflowers are almost all perennials, there's some biennials and there's an occasional annual, but the vast majority of them are perennials. And so they take usually about 3 years to mature and reach blooming stage. So the first year with the prairie seeding, all you see are weeds, and you keep them mowed back to 6 inches. So I'm guessing that you have a mix that probably has a lot of annuals, a few biennials, and a few perennials. This is typically what you see in these so-called wildflower mixes. And unfortunately, usually their peak year is the first year, because that's when all these annuals go crazy, and they're absolutely gorgeous. The second year, you get biennials like Black-Eyed Susan, and there's a couple others that might be in there. And oftentimes, it depends on the composition of the mix, and without knowing that, there's no way for me to give you any really good advice. But usually, if there's not a lot of perennial component to it, then you typically see kind of a reduction in the flowering, because the annuals do not persist. That's just the nature of their life cycle. They usually show up in the first and the second years, and then they pretty much fade away. So management of that is going to be very different from how you would manage a prairie mix, where you have maturation occurring in the third year and on. So what's going to happen is you're almost certainly going to have to reseed this, unless there's a good perennial component that will come back year after year after year. So without knowing the exact composition, very hard for me to give you specific advice, but I suspect that you're going to have to enhance that area. And here's the other thing. If you just add that same mix into an established 3 or 4 year old planting, the annuals typically will not show up because they need open, bare soil to germinate. So you'll put that seed mix down, overseeding it, expecting all these beautiful annuals, and you'll probably get very few because there won't be any open soil for them to germinate in. So it's could be potentially disappointing. So that's why a lot of people use prairie mixes, because they have perennials that will live, as long as the person who planted them, because they come back and many of them will self-sow, and so you'll get new recruitment of new species over time. So I suspect you're going to probably see some reduction in flowering, and you may at some point need to start over and maybe add some more perennials.
Yeah. Mary, there you go. Good luck, and thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller with Neil DeBoll, president of Prairie Nursery, for Garden Talk. Next week on the show, we'll be talking about planting bulbs with Mark Conlock from the Green Bay Botanical Gardens on Garden Talk next week during the show. But right now, we're talking prairie plants with Neil DeBoll, president of Prairie Nursery. And again, join in 800-642-1234. You can email to talk@WPR.org. Christy in Chippewa Falls, what's on your mind?
Hi, thanks a lot. So here in Chippewa, I've cut back the buckthorn and letting the berries germinate and doing a broad-spectrum herbicide. I'm getting back to really nice sandy loam, almost full sun. So what I just listened to the buckwheat green manure cycle. So perhaps that might be the next step. And then what to plant after that? So like a long-term management where buckthorn's really sick, like so many of us are dealing with.
Okay, let me ask you a few questions, Christy. Are there any trees above this buckthorn, or is there shade, or was it just a solid buckthorn stand and now it's completely wide open to the sun?
Good question. Left a few remnant native cherry and a maple or two, and I've gone in and added a balsam for some green winter color.
Okay, so a prairie needs at least 50% direct sun. Most prairie plants need 50% direct sun per day. So we have to be careful about making sure we have sufficient sun when we have trees in the landscape as well. So you want to make sure that the prairie is only planted in the areas where you've got plenty of sun, at least a half a day of full sun. More is even better. Okay, so that's the first thing. And then the second thing, the buckwheat winter wheat or winter rye rotation is generally most effective on large acreages and not on small areas. And the reason for that is because on small areas you have edges where sun can come in and you don't get the smothering effect. So you really want a larger plot of land that doesn't have a lot of edges around it. So if you're working on small plots, you're probably going to be farther ahead just to continue your herbicide treatments if that's acceptable. And that is going to give you really good control. It'll give you actually better control than the buckwheat, winter wheat, or at least as good with a lot less work. So how many years ago did you cut down the buckthorn?
I started 2 years ago. And so then with that sunlight issue, so then what would I plant if not needed support?
Okay, well, after you've got everything completely killed, and your buckthorn seedlings, thankfully, buckthorn seedlings, in my experience, usually only stay viable in the soil for a couple of years, unlike something like garlic mustard, where the seeds can stay viable for 10 years. So usually a couple of years of site preparation, not allowing the buckthorn seedlings to survive, puts you in a position where you can seed something or install plants. So the plants that you install will be a function of your soils. You have sandy loam, so you want something that will grow in a well-drained, nice sandy loam, not dry, not wet, and then you have to take the sun and shade conditions into consideration. And if you have more than a half a day of shade, then you're going to be leaning more towards woodland plants. And when you get into woodland species, the seed availability is less, and it's very much more expensive than prairie plants. So seeding may not be the way to go in shady areas under the trees. You may want to use transplants. And a way to be cost-effective with that is to create little patches of transplants so they get more bang for the buck. Using the rule of three, put three or five, maybe even seven in one area. But then you have to put something else down around that shaded area. So there are woodland sedges, the genus Carex. They're grass-like plants. They don't get too tall, and they make wonderful, wonderful companions for your lower-growing woodland wildflowers. So there are a number of woodland sedges that you can use. And if you go to our website, you'll see that we have a number of them available as transplants. Seeds are a little trickier. But if you're going to do a planting in a woodland area, make sure you do it in the fall, because both the woodland seeds and the sedges do best when seeded in the fall to go through that cold, damp condition over winter to break seed dormancy and increase their germination the following year. So if you have a sunny area, more than half a day of full sun, that's a perfect spot for a prairie mix or prairie plants. And if the area is 50% or more shade, then you're moving more into the woodland zone. And there are many woodland plants that will grow kind of in that intermediate area. And there are some prairie plants that will grow in that intermediate sun, like purple coneflower, golden alexanders, orange coneflower. There are a number of different species that you can utilize. And you can go to our website, and if you go to our wet wildflowers, grasses, et cetera section, you can put in the parameters of shade, soil, soil moisture, height. You can select the height and make sure that you use a height that's appropriate for the rest of the landscape. You may not want 10-foot tall plants in there. You may want to keep plants a little bit shorter in a small area, taller in a large area. So you want to select the plants to match both your design as well as your growing conditions and the light conditions and soil conditions. I hope that helps a little bit.
That help, Christy?
Very much so. I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Liz in Eau Claire has a question. Let's go there. Liz, hi.
Hi there.
What can we do for you?
Well, I have two questions, actually. I have a plants coming to plant this fall that are cranesbill geranium, a low-growing, I'm hoping to be a ground cover someday, and shrubby St. John's wort, which is a low-growing shrub. And both of these are supposed to be resistant, in quotation marks, to deer and rabbits. So I'm wondering, when these come, they'll be in 4 inches, like about 4-inch little pipes. How much should they be watered this fall? That's question number one. Can I go ahead with two?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, question two is, I have a smallish, it's not a big prairie field, a pollinator garden in my urban yard. And I have had a wonderful year, but I have asters. I don't know the kind. A neighbor gave me a little bunch. And a zigzag goldenrod. And they haven't bloomed yet. They have little fat bulbs, but there's no blooms. Are they going to come, or is it too late? That's my question.
Okay. Well, we'll start with the watering. Both wild geranium and shrubby St. John's wort like a medium soil. They don't like it dry. They don't like it wet. And especially the shrubby St. John's wort, you don't want to overwater that. So it likes a well-drained soil, and it will spread. It will kind of creep, and it's a great ground cover. A lot of people use it like above stone walls to give a softening to the upper part of the wall. There's a lot of different applications. And the cranium geranium, wild geranium, or cranesbill geranium also likes a rich but not a wet soil. So just water them enough to get them established. And if it rains regularly, you shouldn't have to add any more water. One of the biggest mistakes people do, especially in the fall when it's cool, is to overwater their plants. Because in the summer, if you plant your plants in May and then you get the hot weather in summer, they're going to dry out. But in the fall, the drying out process is greatly reduced because you don't have the hot temperatures and the drier conditions. So be moderate with the watering. Your second question?
Well, it had to do with blooms. Or
yes,
no blooms.
yes, asters and goldenrods, you know, some of them are just starting to bloom now, but the vast majority of them are September, October bloomers. So most of my goldenrods, especially the zigzag goldenrod, has not bloomed yet. And without knowing what your aster is, it's hard to say. But you have a New England aster, for instance, usually doesn't bloom until October. So late September, and they'll bloom all the way into November. So it depends. Different years are different. But I would not give up on them. There's probably time for them to show up, especially if they have little buds on them. Then that's almost for sure you're going to get blooms.
All right. Liz, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in, too. Open lines get you on pretty quickly here at 800-642-1234. Ellie in Middleton emailed that she and her spouse want to turn their terrace, the space between the sidewalk and the road, into a wildflower butterfly garden. And wondering, what can they do now? Is it is currently sort of a crappy lawn. Should they use a sod cutter and seed this fall? Any other considerations for a small area so near the road?
Well, let's talk about the basics of putting in native plants in that strip between the sidewalk and the road. Number one, don't use a seed mix because it's going to be messy for the first couple years and you're going to get a lot of complaints. Use transplants. It's a small area. when you look at the cost, it's not terrible, and you can do it in phases. Like, say you have 100 feet, you could do like 25 feet a year and just phase it in. That makes less work, costs you less money, et cetera. Number two, use lower growing plants that don't get too tall, because that's what freaks people out. Keep them in the 1 to 3 foot range, and make sure you don't have floppy plants. Okay, because then floppy plants fall over the sidewalk, and then people trip on them, and you know, you've created a hazard. So you want to use more compact plants. Some of your grasses, like prairie drop seed. Prairie drop seed is a fantastic, fantastic grass. It's long-lived. It will grow in dry. It will grow in clay. It will grow in sand. It doesn't seem to care. Just don't stick it in water, and it'll probably grow. But it's got to have sun. It's got to have lots of sun. So the other grasses, you can use little blue stem that gets about 3 feet tall, and it's upright. So if you're using the prairie drop seed, it's a clumper, so don't put it too close to the sidewalk. Put it in at least 18 inches away from the sidewalk so nobody trips over it. And you can put in plants like butterfly weed if you have a sandy soil. You can put in purple coneflower, and even pale purple coneflower, which will get 5 feet tall. It doesn't flop. It's straight. It's very strong. It doesn't fall over. So make sure you know the plants and make sure you know how they're going to work with the soil, and make sure it's not a hazard, and put up a sign, butterfly garden. Nobody can complain about a butterfly garden.
That's a very, very good tip.
Okay. So what to do now? It really depends upon the weeds that are in there. If you've got most weedy lawns have quackgrass and dandelions and stuff. Dandelions are pretty easy to kill, and they're usually not a terribly long-term threat to a prairie because they are easily dispatched once the prairie matures. But if you have rhizomatous perennial grasses, including bluegrass, I mean, bluegrass is a really strong competitor, Kentucky bluegrass. So you need to eliminate all that. Can you dig everything out? That's the way you could plant something this fall. You could just go in there and dig out all the roots. A lot of work, but it works. The other choice, if it's allowable, you can spray it with herbicides now. Let it sit over the winter. Let the weeds come up. Any that did not get killed this fall, let them come up next spring. And then usually around mid to late May, you can spray them a second time to finish them off. And then you can put in your plants in late May.
There you go. I was thinking about my own. I have a very similar spot where I've had very good luck with prairie plants. Except they're redoing the street in front of my house, and they didn't tell me they were going to be doing some work there. And if they had, I would have been digging up a lot of coneflowers and other. And so I'm left that 20-foot stretch there, a little longer, with about 3 feet of purple coneflowers. There's no end in sight yet. So I think it'll be next spring for me.
Yeah. So they dug everything out. They took the soil and the plants away.
Yeah.
Oh boy. Yeah. Oh boy. And they didn't tell you. How about that, huh?
Well, they no. In fact, somebody told me that they were going to try and save them because they were so pretty, and look so good. So I'll be starting over. I do have those few purple coneflowers, but all the rest of the plants are gone. So
wow, that's a shame.
Yeah, it is indeed. And woe is me. Here's Jan in Amherst. It's your turn. Hi, Jan.
Hi. I heard a caller talk about getting rid of her buckthorn. I have a real problem with it. It's choking out my woods, and I don't know how to get rid of it.
How much area are you dealing with in square feet, acres, et cetera?
Oh, about 10 acres.
Oh, boy. Okay, you got to call in the military. Okay, not the National Guard. Sorry about that. Yeah, actually, you could use the National Guard. They could be better deployed getting rid of buckthorn. So what can we do here? 10 acres is a very large area. So the most efficient way usually to deal with buckthorn on that scale is you want to call in somebody with a brush mulching machine. They come in and you want to mark the trees. Or hopefully you have somebody that knows forestry. They're called forestry mulchers, and they come in and they take down. It just chops up and grinds up all the buckthorns. I mean, even great big buckthorns, it'll grind them up. Okay, but you want to preserve the valuable trees, and that depends on what you consider valuable. So you want to go through and either mark those trees so that whoever comes in doesn't destroy them, or if you have a knowledgeable person, you say, look, just take the buckthorn, and then you can deal with the remainders later. So what they do is they come in and they just, this machine has this big head on it, and it just grinds everything up. Now, that doesn't kill the buckthorn. It's going to come back from the roots. But after they go in there and grind everything up, you let them resprout. And then you can go in August of the next year. Let's say normally they will do this in the winter. And you usually want to, as long as there's not a lot of snow, if you have any valuable flowers or anything else in there, you want to make sure you do this work in the winter so you don't disturb it if the soil is damp and they rot it up. In the winter when it's frozen, it won't rot it up and damage any of your desirable vegetation. So they cut down all the buckthorn, chop it all up, and you'll have all this residue there. But you let the buckthorn and any other invasive species that you designate to be cut down, then you let them resprout. And then you come in August once they've grown back up. And you want to wait until August until they're fully developed. And then you can go and treat them individually with herbicide. Get a backpack sprayer and go out there and spray them with the necessary herbicide. It depends on what you're spraying. If you're dealing with buckthorn, you can use an herbicide called Milestone. And this is the only herbicide I found that will kill it one and done without mixing it with others. So Milestone is known as aminopyralid, like amino acid, P-Y-R-A-L-I-D. And you spray that in August or September, and you're going to smoke that buckthorn into the oblivion. You won't have. You can also use a mixture, but this depends on what you're trying to do. This is a silvicide, and so silvicides are designed mostly to kill trees and shrubs. And you can spray aminopyralid on garlic mustard, and it bounces right off. So it's really interesting. So you can also use a mixture of Garlon and Roundup. Garlon is triclopyr, T-R-I-C-L-O-P-Y-R, triclopyr. You mix that with Roundup, and you'll kill damn near anything. Okay, I mean, everything, mostly. Okay, there are a few exceptions, but that'll get almost anything. So if you have other desirable vegetation in there that you don't want to kill, you want to be very careful about the herbicides you use. But you can take Milestone, and let's say you have Tartarian honeysuckle, which is another highly invasive species, especially in southwestern Wisconsin. It's just everywhere. You spray Milestone on that, and the leaves will fall off, and it'll come back the next year. You won't kill it. But if you use Roundup, glyphosate, and you spray that on honeysuckle, it's gone, baby, out of here. So you want to be very specific about what herbicide you use. So Milestone is great on buckthorn. And the other choice is to go out there and cut every single one of those stems of buckthorn to the ground in the fall or winter and then apply 40% undiluted Roundup to the cambium just inside the bark. But that is on 10 acres, that would take you a lifetime, because that's what I've done on my 20-acre farm over the last 30 years is do that. And that's why my knees are shot from crawling around on the ground. So if you get in there with a brush mower and then treat them when they come back with a foliar spray, that's going to be your most efficient way to get rid of them. And then you've got 2 to 3 years of the seeds germinating, and then you have to spend time controlling that before you plant anything. So it's a real project.
A real project, Jan. Good luck. And I appreciate your call very much. Kitty had just called in to suggest getting goats to eat up the buckthorn, because they will eat buckthorn.
They'll eat anything. Okay, you want to do goats? I used goats on a project outside of Philadelphia many years ago. What you have to do is any valuable tree, you have to fence it like 8 feet tall. Okay, because those goats are going to crawl up there, and they're going to strip the bark off of everything. And so they are phenomenal. And goats are the nicest critters. I just stopped by a friend of mine's house on Saturday with, she had 10 little baby goats, and they're so cute. Oh, my God. But anyway, we're getting off track. So goats will just chew up everything. The problem is they won't kill the buckthorn, because all they're doing is eating the top part. Okay, once that's gone, the root is still there, and you take the goats away, and it will resprout. Now, they will mow everything down, but they won't kill it. So now you have to decide what you're going to do to kill that buckthorn. If you can let it do the same thing as with the brush mower, a mulcher, then you can let it resprout and spray it with herbicide if that's acceptable. It's way easier than digging out the roots, which is a tremendous amount of work. Some people, they like the old-fashioned way. They just go out there and just put a chain around those buckthorns and yank them out of the ground. Well, that's the satisfactory, you know, macho way to do it. Okay, and it makes a giant mess, and you're ripping everything out of the ground. And if you have any decent vegetation in there, it's going to rip all the little wildflowers out. So it's kind of a, you know, a guy with a big truck thing or a tractor thing. So it may not be your best choice. Okay. So you want to make sure that you have your plan in place on how you're going to do this, whether it's goats, herbicides, mulching mowers, or whatever. You're going to need to, or forestry mowers, you're going to make sure you know every single stage of this and then how you're going to handle it. And I've been doing this for 30 years on my property, and it's not easy. Prairies are easy. Woodland restorations are difficult. And then you finally get everything under control, and you plant your seeds, and you have trees. And who perches in the trees? Little birdies. And what do little birdies do? They poop out buckthorn seeds and honeysuckle seeds. And so it's a never-ending struggle. Okay, so... Surrender, earthlings. Resistance is futile. I know, it sounds crazy. I have some really beautiful woodland restorations, and once you get it going, it's good. But getting there is not easy, and I don't want anybody to think that this is an easy, simple process, because it's not. But once it's there, it is gorgeous. I got bluebells, and I got all sorts of wonderful wildflowers, trilliums, and all the stuff that comes up. And I just have to go out and pull all the buckthorns and little seedlings. You get them under seedlings, like the old Arab proverb, if you're going to kill a snake, kill it when it's young. Go get those seedlings. Don't let them grow.
Jan, there you go. Thanks for calling. Bob in Dakota, Minnesota has something for us. Hi, Bob.
Hey, Larry. I've got a nice patch of milkweed that came up all on its own a few years ago. And for the last 2 years now, from the bottom up, the leaves will turn yellow and they just start dropping like the middle of August. Is that normal, or is that early?
That's not abnormal. Did you have a lot of dry weather in that interim there? Because we had some pretty dry weather after July into August, and sometimes they'll just kind of start dropping their leaves.
Not necessarily. I just was curious if there was some bug coming up and just one by one knocking them out or something.
Well, that is possible. We do see the lower leaves of milkweed starting to drop sometimes in August. It's not atypical. I am not an entomologist, so I can't say that was caused by a certain bug or anything. But I'll tell you one thing that's fascinating. The ecology of the common milkweed plant is phenomenal. You can just Google this. Okay, all the different insects and bugs that actually utilize milkweeds is nothing short of amazing. All of the milkweeds, but common milkweed is particularly amazing. There's all these different insects, and there's insects that depend upon those insects. It's an absolutely incredible, incredible community of creatures that utilize that plant. So it's very possible that there was something that was, you know, maybe sucking the juice out of it or something that would have led to that. But sometimes you just see that as a natural phenomenon.
There you go, Bob. Thank you very much for calling. Neil DeBole, our guest today, president of Prairie Nursery and a consulting ecologist. I'm Larry Mailer for Garden Talk on WPR News. Thanks for joining us today on Garden Talk. In the last segment, the last half hour of the show, we've been getting some weed questions, and weed scientist Mark Renz will be with us to talk about the latest invasive weed to be found in Wisconsin. It's called stilt grass, and believe me, you don't want it. And we'll talk about that and probably answer some other weed questions as well as we move along. But right now we're talking prairies with our guest Neil DeBole, and you can join in 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. Barry in Spring Valley has a question. Hi, Barry.
Good morning. A year ago, I started establishing a prairie, mowed it, and took an old-fashioned farm digger and dug it all summer long. And after the fact, I come to realize what I was doing by digging it quite deep was pulling up seeds from probably 1850. So this summer, I have taken just a four-wheeler and put a light drag on it, like a six-foot drag, wide drag, and I'm going back and forth on it. There's real tiny weeds that start to grow, and with the drag, I kill them. And my theory is that since I was pulling up all of the old weeds last year, the seeds, and this year I'm just working the soil not very deep, and then I plan on planting this fall, like October, November, whatever. So you think that is going to work?
Well, Barry, it's a method that I've used for over 40 years, and it can work and it may not work, and here's why. First of all, and I'm really glad you brought this up, because I mentioned tilling every month or so, and with your old-fashioned, what, some kind of a cultivator or a quack digger, what were you using to work the ground up?
Well, you know, in the old days, it was you planted corn and then you dragged it with a drag. It was just about a 3 or 4 inch sharp.
But the first one you did was a dig. What did you use the first time?
A cultivator.
Yeah.
Well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So what you did, you're absolutely right. You brought up weed seeds, and that is one of the issues when you're using repeated cultivation. There is that bad downside of bringing up weed seeds. There are always weed seeds in the soil, and there's no way you're going to get rid of them all short of sterilizing the soil, which is pretty much illegal these days. So, well, what you're doing there works really well. By using the drag, I've used that on my production fields where I killed everything off, similar to what you're talking about, and then would drag the field right after you start to see the weeds come up. And the old farmer saying is, if you can see the weeds, it's too late. You're when they're just starting to come up, okay? And then you do it on a hot, sunny day, just do it in the morning, and they dry out by the end of the day, and they're gone. The only issue with this is that if you have a very high weed seed density in that field, the percentage of the weeds that you're going to eliminate using this method in 1 year is probably possibly going to be low, and you may not see any real advantage. It all depends upon the weed seed load in that soil. But in soils that don't have a high weed seed load, this can be quite effective. So it's a very good, it's worked very well in some situations where I've used it, but there are other situations where there were a lot of weeds and it didn't make any difference.
Yeah. So, in terms of seeding this fall, he should be doing that sooner than later, or?
No, the timing isn't critical. Here's a really another important question about seeding in the fall. If you're on a slope and it's subject to erosion, you really want to get that seeded no later than September 15th, and you want to put a cover crop on there, usually a cover crop of oats at about 100 to 150 pounds per acre that you add to the prairie seed at the time of seeding. The oats will germinate and develop a root system and help hold that soil into the winter. You do not want to use winter wheat or winter rye, because if you plant winter wheat or winter rye, it will overwinter and it will completely swamp everything in the next spring, and it will probably ruin your prairie. That's why we use oats, because oats usually die. You get to about 13 to 15 degrees Fahrenheit, and the oats will winter kill. Winter wheat and winter rye are aptly named because they will survive the winter, and they will come back the next spring. If you have And there's some really fine adjustments you can make here. If you have a erosion-prone slope and you're worried about it being held in the spring, you can use the 100 pounds plus of oats per acre, and then you can put in like 10 to 20 pounds of winter wheat. Do not use winter rye. It is highly allelopathic, and it will use its chemical warfare against your good guys. They will not stand a chance. Winter wheat is slightly allelopathic, moderately allelopathic, but it does not completely wipe everything out. So if you do not use anywhere near the typical seeding rate of about 100 pounds per acre of winter rye, you would use a tenth of that, like 10 pounds per acre, maybe 15, rarely 20. You can add that to the oats, and then that will stay green. It will survive the winter and then provide you with some cover the next spring. But be super careful if you're using that so you don't put in too much.
All right.
So that's only on erosion-prone sites. If it's level, just use the oats, and you are good to go. And if you don't have a lot of worry about erosion, I would not include the winter wheat.
Barry, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Paul in Winona, Minnesota has a question. Hi, Paul.
Good morning. Thank you. I always enjoy this show. You helped me out a couple of years ago getting rid of some goldenrod, and that was very successful. Thank you. Question this year, though, is I'd like to know your ideas on the impact of spring burning, either doing it earlier, doing it later, and how that affects the balance between the grasses and the flowers. I burnt late this year, and it seems like I got a lot more big blue stem than I ended up with flowers.
That is exactly what you would expect, yes. So fire is a very fascinating tool, and the results of the burning a prairie will depend very much on the timing. So if we look at spring burning, we have early spring, mid-spring, and late spring, and then we have fall. Okay, so fall burning, generally speaking, and that's after everything has pretty much gone senescent for the year, usually late October, November, that tends to be a fairly neutral burn because it's not favoring grasses, flowers, or anything. It's just removing the old vegetation so things will green up early in the spring, and that will really help your early spring blooming flowers. So a fall burning does help the early spring blooming flowers, but it doesn't give them any, it doesn't really change the balance of the flowers and grasses significantly in the total prairie. It just helps the early ones. A early spring burn will prevent damage to early emerging flowers. A mid-spring burn will slightly damage some of your early emerging flowers, depending on what they are. And then a late spring burn will really favor the warm season grasses because most of them are just emerging or have not come up yet, sustaining very little damage, but many of your flowers can be 6 to 12 inches tall, so you're going to blast them, and they're going to lose their new growth. They will not have had an opportunity to replenish their root reserves with their new growth, so they're going to be at a significant disadvantage to the warm season grasses. So what to do? First of all, never burn your prairie every year, unless you're burning in the fall. But remember, if you're burning in the fall, you're removing all that cover and all that potential habitat for birds, for foraging, also a lot of your pollinators overwinter in the stems and the seed heads and in the litter of the prairie. So you're really not helping your pollinators and some of the butterflies and other species that are overwintering. So a fall burning, while effective, doesn't help you in the total community standpoint of pollinators, et cetera. So what a lot of people will do is they will burn, depending on what they're fighting. If you're fighting against cool season weeds and grasses like quackgrass, bluegrass, smooth brome grass, most people will burn around mid-April. So that's after the target unwanted non-native grasses and clovers come up. So you're harming them. But most of your prairie plants have not yet emerged or are slightly emerging. Exceptions to this are dry prairies where you have lots of early blooming flowers like pasque flowers and puccoons and prairie smoke. These come up early. These are generally best burned in the fall because you will not damage those species. If you do a mid-spring burn in a dry prairie, you're going to hurt some of those plants, and you're going to hurt them pretty badly. So it depends on the plant community. Most people have a medium soil or mesic prairie. So burning every other year around mid-April will help control unwanted cool season flowers and grasses, weeds and grasses, without significantly impacting the flower-to-grass ratio. The later in the season you burn, the more you're going to hurt the flowers and favor the warm season grasses. If you burn every year, you're going to push it towards the grasses. So you want to do it every other year, and here's why every other year. It's because if you go 3 years, if you have woody invaders like buckthorn, honeysuckle, black walnut, etc., if they grow for 2 years, a burn every other year will usually kill those seedlings. You go 3 years, they've developed enough root system to survive that three-year burn. So there's a lot of factors that come into play here. So you want to know what your prairie is, when it should be burned, and what the bad guys are, and how often you have to burn it.
And by early spring, you mean?
Early spring would be like late March, early May. Late March, early April.
Okay.
So if you like pasque flower and prairie smoke, these things, they come up really early.
Yeah.
Okay, so you want to get them burned before those things start growing. April 1 usually would be kind of your deadline for a dry prairie with those. It depends on the year. Okay, and like this year, you didn't burn. It was a late spring, so you weren't burning until late April, early May. If generally speaking, if you're trying to control cool season grasses and clovers, burning when the buds of the sugar maple tree are just breaking open will give you very good results without terribly harming your flowers. But again, you don't want to do this every year, because if you do this every year, you're going to push it to the grasses.
Okay.
Here's the problem. We're missing a really important element in our prairies. Bison and elk, because they eat grass and they don't eat flowers. And you got to have you better tether a bison in your prairie. And now you got the whole package.
Neil DeBole, our guest today, president of Prairie Nursery. It's great to have him with us. And he'll be with us through the next half hour. So we're looking forward to talking with him. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Or you could email talk@wpr.org. We'll take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on WPR News, and then back with Neil. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking prairie gardening on Garden Talk today. Larry Mueller here. Always great to have Neil DeBull with us. He's the president of Prairie Nursery and a consulting ecologist, also co-author of the highly regarded book, The Gardener's Guide to Prairie Plants. Great to have him along. Lots of callers online, lots of emails. So let's get right to it. A listener emailed to ask, what's the best approach to establishing prairie dock on one's urban homestead, and what ecological benefits do prairie dock provide?
Well, if you have a small area, it's best to put in individual plants. And since prairie dock is a very large plant, it has leaves that can get 2 to 3 feet tall. They look like giant elephant ears. They're really very striking, one of the coolest prairie plants, in my opinion. And the flower stalks can go up to 10 feet high. So you don't need a lot of prairie dock to make a statement. So they look really good in as individuals, or you can put them together in groups of three where you space them about 2 feet apart on a triangle. That looks great. So unless you have a really big area, I would use transplants. Otherwise, you can use seeds, and you can plant those seeds in the fall to increase the germination by exposure to cold, damp conditions over the winter in the soil. But if it's a small area, definitely go with the plants. And then prairie dock attracts a lot of different insects, and it also is very close relative to the sunflower, so it has large, very high oil seeds that birds love. So you're going to get habitat both in pollinator attraction as well as bird activity in the fall.
Jim emailed us. He started a backyard prairie with mostly little blue stem and Cytos grama a few years ago, doing quite well. However, their neighbor's yard is now nearly 100% weeds, including Canada thistle, bindweed, creeping bellflower, and these weeds are now entering Jim's property and popping up, sort of adjacent to the prairie. Wondering if the prairie will be able to withstand these weeds.
Oh, man, that's a rogues gallery. That's some bad stuff you got going there. So, no, a field bindweed, and what was it? Was it Canada goldenrod? Did you say Canada
thistle, bindweed, and creeping bellflower?
Yeah. These are nasty, nasty weeds, and even they can get into a prairie. So, and they're hard to dig out, as we talked about with Canada goldenrod. Canada thistle, it has roots that can go a couple of feet deep. Very hard to dig out, especially if you have existing vegetation. And also the field bindweed, it's got these little bitty bulbs that are so hard to dig out, too. So what do you do? I hate to say it, but the most efficient and effective way is to use herbicides. And you can kill Canada thistle with either milestone, aminopyrrolid, or with clopyrrolid. There's a number of different things you can kill it with, but those are two that are commonly used. Clopyrrolid, which is Garlon. And for field bindweed, the number one way to kill field bindweed is with an herbicide called Drive, just like driving a car. And that's the actual name for use on in grasses is quinclorac, quinclorac. And that, when used according to directions, it will not harm the grass. It will kill other flowers, but it will not harm the grass. And so you can use all sorts of other broadleaf herbicides on field bindweed, but quinclorac or Drive, that is the one that's going to get it. Okay.
Karen in Madison has a related question to that, I believe. Karen, hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I have new neighbors in the past 3 years who I live in on the far east side of a suburban lot, and they hired someone to put in a prairie in their front yard because they didn't want to cut the grass, and they had not been cutting the grass, and now it's a total eyesore. And maybe you could talk about a startup of a prairie garden and what you have to do to it's just terrible.
So it's neglected. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. So there's design characteristics that need to be taken into consideration. So it sounds like this is not a prairie garden. This was sown with seed. Again, going back to the differentiation between a garden where you would put in transplants in an organized fashion versus a more meadow-like situation where you're using seeds, which, unless specifically planted in certain areas, is going to be just a random a look, which is fine as long as you are prepared for that. And that's normally what we do is we just let the plants kind of sort themselves out. Here's the issue. If you're putting your whole front yard into a prairie, have a little respect for your neighbors. Leave a little bit of mowed lawn, like 3 or 4 or 5 feet on both sides for your other neighbors, as well as along the sidewalk. Don't have the prairie come right up to the edge. Just general, good neighborliness. Then follow the directions for managing a prairie in the first growing season. You keep it mowed back to 6 inches because very few of the prairie seedlings from seed are going to get taller than 6 inches. And when the weeds get to a foot tall, you whack them back. Just go out with a weed whacker on a small area and knock them back to 6 inches. So the prairie plants are less than 6 inches. They're not harmed. The weeds, if left untended, they're going to get 6 feet high and be a mess and a threat to your neighbors. So now you're a really bad neighbor. You'll keep it mowed back to 6 inches consistently, probably 3 or 4 times in the first growing season. The second year, you're going to start to get some biennials like black-eyed Susan, maybe you have some brown-eyed Susan in there, but they'll come later in the season. We typically will see a problem with biennial weeds like yellow sweet clover, white sweet clover. Sometimes you'll have wild parsnip, you may have bull thistle, you may have Queen Anne's lace, which many people don't consider a weed, but it is certainly a weed in a native prairie. So you need to control these. This is where you get into a problem where they will get up fairly tall because you want to wait until they finish blooming and then you cut them down to 12 inches. Most of your prairie plants won't be taller than 12 inches when you're cutting these biennial weeds, usually in mid-July. The reason you cut in mid-July is because you wait until they finish flowering. Most biennials, with the exception of Queen Anne's lace, when cut at 12 inches after they just finished blooming, will kill the plant and the seeds will not form. They will not be attached to the plant anymore, so you can just leave them on the ground if you want. And you don't have to worry about it. So now you're down to 12 inches. So then your black-eyed Susan show up and your brown-eyed Susan show up, and it's starting to look like something. But you got to make sure you talk to your neighbors and everybody knows what's going on. And then in the third year, normally we start burning in the third year, but you want to be careful when you're burning your front yard, especially if you have a siding that's made out of vinyl, because I learned that the hard way on my office. Don't do that. It really doesn't take a lot of temperature to deform that vinyl. Okay. I can burn prairie up to 1 foot of a frame wooden house. No problem with a hose. Playing the hose on the wood. But vinyl, forget about it. Anyway, you're probably not going to burn it. You're going to mow it because you're in town. And you're going to mow it back. You don't want to burn anything close to your building. And you want to do that usually in mid to late April. And then you clean everything up. You left everything stand over the winter for all the different seeds, et cetera, for birds and for insects, et cetera, to overwinter in, as long as your neighbors can tolerate that look. Front yards are tricky. The prairie normally is in the backyard because you have issues. I'm a firm believer in front yard prairies. My front yard has a prairie in it, but I don't have neighbors. I'm on a hill away from everybody, so it doesn't matter. So you want to be really careful how you design that prairie. Make sure you have some mowed borders around it and be intentional. And make it look like a nice shape. Make it look like you actually put some thought into it so it has some design parameters to it. And by the third year, your coneflowers are going to start to bloom, and you might get some blazing stars, your butterfly weed, depending on what's in your mix, and it'll start to look good, and your neighbors won't hate you anymore.
So what should Karen do with her neighbor? Give him your book?
Get a copy of my book, The Gardener's Guide to Prairie Plants, or you can just go to our website, prairienursery.com, and there's tons of information under our Learning Center. So if you go to the Prairie Nursery website, over to the right on the homepage, you'll see Learning Center. And then there's all sorts of information. You go to the left, and there's prairies and our no-mow lawn mix. It's a low-maintenance lawn mix. And then there's a download center at the very bottom where there's all sorts of technical articles that you can read, including managing prairie meadows. But I think the most important thing is that she'd take a cake over to the neighbor and say, hey, I just wanted to say hi, and I got some tips for you on how to help your prairie look better.
All right, Karen. Thanks so much for calling. Another Karen in Madison called in to remind us that the space between the road and the sidewalk is owned by the municipality. This goes back to an earlier question. So check to make sure what you can plant there, if anything.
That's a really good point.
Yeah.
Really good point. Yep.
Yeah, very good point.
In Madison, a lot of people do this, as you see.
Yeah.
But no, it's not everywhere is just going to go over. In fact, a friend of mine, Lauren Springer, who's a really fantastic garden designer, she pioneered what she called hell strips in Windsor, Colorado, which is in the eastern part of Colorado where they get like 15 inches of rain a year. And she turned these just weed-infested clay hell holes, hell strips, as she calls them, into these beautiful gardens using the appropriate plants. So she's been doing this since the 80s. So it's a really, it's developing and it's coming along, but it does require coordination with your local authorities.
And Megan in Sauk City emailed to ask what she should do about powdery mildew on her bee balm.
Oh, boy, powdery mildew on bee balm. You know, the Monardas, which includes bee balm, bergamot, and others, are so susceptible to powdery mildew. So the question becomes, do you just tolerate it or do you fight it? So there are various ways to control mildews. The old-fashioned way is to use elemental sulfur, and you can mix that with water and spray it onto the plants. Dusting it is possible, but it's kind of messy and it's not really effective. And then there are fungicides that you can use. So normally you will rotate fungicides and sulfur, and you might use two different fungicides. So you use one fungicide, then sulfur, then another fungicide, then the first fungicide, then sulfur, because there's some issues apparently with becoming resistant to it. So, and this works pretty well, but it's like a weekly thing. So you got to go out and apply this like every single week during hot, humid weather. So powdery mildew can be a real problem in the greenhouse too. Sometimes when we have the right conditions or what we would consider the wrong conditions, it can really be a quick outbreak and it can make a mess of things pretty darn fast. So you want to be Johnny on the spot when you see symptoms of this.
Jane emailed, she has reed canary grass on a half to three quarters of an acre in a lower, wetter area, standing water for a day or two after heavy rains, that kind, is south of Sun Prairie. There's also some milkweed and goldenrod mixed in some of those areas. She would love to eliminate the reed's canary grass and replace it with native prairie plants and wonders if you have advice.
Well, reed canary grass is a really, really tough competitor. That's one of the top tough ones out there. So you have a couple of different approaches for it. This gets pretty pretty technical, but you have, number one, you have a really tough way. Burn it in June, mid-June, when the reed canary grass is 5-6 feet tall and flowering. Burn it in June, and that will whack that reed canary grass into oblivion, and the native forbs, flowers, et cetera, in there will recover, and sedges, native sedges will recover if they're in there, if they're underneath that canopy. I have used this method, other people have, and it's a miraculous transformation by August. You can't believe it. The reed canary grass is still there, but it is so reduced because you're hitting it at its most weak time when it's taking the maximum amount of energy out of its roots to make flowers and bloom, and you burn it to the ground. This is the messiest, nastiest, most acrid smoke you will ever have in a prairie fire. So you want to be really careful. And when you set your backfire, that's when you're going to be inhaling the smoke. So you got to be super careful. You may want to actually wear a respirator. Then it makes a huge difference, and you can do this every couple of years and really keep the reed canary grass in control. Another option is, if the reed canary grass area is dry in mid-June when it's in bloom, you can go and mow it using mowing to the ground, as close to the ground as you can, as a substitute for fire. So you don't have to go out there and deal with the burning all that green material that's so nasty. Okay. Another choice is to use a grass-selective herbicide that will knock back the grass. It'll also knock back other potentially native grasses that you have in there. So you want to make sure you've done an analysis of what's in there before you go and spray anything. But reed canary grass is, you know, it's a really tough customer. So clethodim, also known as select, and let me spell that for you, C-L-E-T-H-O-D-I-M. Okay?
Okay.
So there are a number of grass selective herbicides. There's cefoxitin, there's clethodim, and there's fluazafop, p-butyl. Okay? But clethodim is recognized as pretty darn effective in killing reed canary grass, or at least setting it back. Okay? And so you will find that clethodim, and then usually you want to do this, in early to mid-June when it's most susceptible, or you can then follow up with another treatment in September. Okay. So clethodim is sold under the trade names of Select, just like it sounds, S-E-L-E-C-T, and more commonly as Envoy Plus, ENVOYPLUS. Now, when using clethodim or cefoxitim, which is different, that's but it's very similar related, you want to use a non-ionic surfactant to mix with it, because this is a water-based herbicide. The non-ionic surfactant allows the herbicide to penetrate the leaf more effectively. Okay, so make sure you use a non-ionic surfactant.
All right.
Okay, and that will take care of it. Well, it's going to really set it back. Okay, killing reed canary grass, yow, that's pretty tough. But clethodim is pretty doggone effective at knocking it back, and that will then free up the other plants because of the reduction in the competition from the reed canary grass. The problem is when you reduce the density of the reed canary grass, there may be other weedy species that show up after you've removed it because nature abhors a vacuum. So you're going to open up Pandora's box, and it might be good and it might be bad.
Well, Brad in Hatfield has something that's overtaken his prairie, I believe. Let's find out from Brad. Hi, Brad. Oh, we lost Brad. We have Gene in Knapp, Wisconsin, with a question.
Hi, Neil. This is Gene up in Knapp. I've got some prairie smoke seed that I'd like to get established. What would be the? It's not a whole, and it's like a small amount because it's pretty expensive seed, and it's got the fuzzy stuff still on it. What would your approach be?
Well, it depends on what your application is. Are you enhancing a given area? Are you growing plants to give away to friends? Are you going to grow the plants and then install them somewhere? What is your plan here?
I'm going to grow them and install them in front
okay.
of. We have a prairie grass area, and we're going to put. We got some forbs in front of it.
Okay. Well, prairie smoke oftentimes. If you collect the seed directly from the plants and then sow it immediately, will oftentimes germinate in the summer. But since it's not summer anymore, the best thing for you to do is to store that seed in a plastic bag dry in a refrigerator, because seed does not like heat and humidity. So you put it in a plastic bag to avoid moisture absorption and put it in your fridge. This is how you can store many seeds, many of which will last for years. In fact, we were talking about prairie duck earlier, and we tested a whole bunch of different seeds, and prairie duck and compass plant, we stored them for 5 years this way, and we actually got higher germination of five-year-old seed than one-year-old seed.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, that is completely counterintuitive. That tells you some interesting things about these plants. At any rate, so you can store a lot of these seeds for quite a while. You can store onion seeds for 20 years, so in a fridge. Anyway, because I get like 90% germination on 20-year-old onion seeds. Who has 20-year-old onion seeds? Only crazy people do this. Anyway. Anyway, so what you do is next early March, take those seeds and mix them with a clean, moisture-absorbent inert material. I like to use sawdust, okay, clean, fresh sawdust, slightly damp. If you can squeeze water out of it, it's too wet, and you mix that seed into the slightly damp sawdust, and the seed will absorb the moisture. You put it in the fridge. 30 days is usually good enough for prairie smoke. And now you are basically mimicking the effect of the seed spending the winter in the soil. And then take it out of the fridge and then sow it into pots or flats or whatever. And you don't have to take it out of the sawdust. You just have to make sure you can see with the seeds. And cover them. The rule of thumb for covering seeds is they should be covered 2 to 3 times their diameter. Okay, well, prairie smoke seed is kind of long. It's not a diameter, but 2 to 3 times its width. Okay, and usually it'll come up within the next 20 to 30 days. It's not the super fastest thing to germinate, but it comes up pretty quickly. Put it in a warm location with indirect light, or you can put it in direct light. But we've got to do this pre-treatment to get really good germination on it, and then they should start coming up when the weather normally warms up. If you do it in early March, they'll be ready in early April, which is our normal cycle for germination in the wild.
Mary emailed. She has a meadow created by seed mix that's now 8 seasons old in central Wisconsin, about an acre. The oxeye sunflower from the seed mix has taken over by reseeding so that it's now the predominant species of 6 to 7 foot tall plants. There are some remaining other native plants intermixed. she would like to save, but what's the best approach to eliminating the oxeye sunflowers? Sunflowers are now expanding to areas outside of the meadow.
Do we know the area of this meadow in terms of square feet?
She's an acre in size.
An acre, so okay, I missed that. Okay, thank you, Larry. Well, what you can do is just after the oxeye sunflowers have bloomed, you can cut them down. Or in this case, you may have to take a brush hog out and mow them. But you want to cut them just so you just cut the heads off so you don't damage the other plants. So that gets a little tricky. So you go out there with your machete and attack them. But I don't know if there's, you can't really lift a weed whacker up that high. That would be very challenging. So you want to do is you want to stop the seed formation. But oxeye sunflowers are perennial, so this would be a long-term process. It's not for the faint of heart. And, you know, it's interesting. Oxeye sunflower was listed as a weed, or I don't know if it was a noxious weed, but it was a weed of concern in Marquette County, where we are, in 1947. So, yes, it can be aggressive by seed. It depends on the site. Some places it behaves itself well. Other places it goes a little crazy. So the other choice, if you want, is you can go and use the glove of death. Now, within an acre, this would take a long time, but you can go out and selectively kill plants by putting on herbicide gloves, heavy-duty rubber or neoprene gloves that go basically almost up to your elbow, and then you put an absorbent cotton glove, a big absorbent cotton glove, over one hand. And then you put Roundup herbicide or broadleaf herbicide to kill the oxeye. If you're dealing with a lot of grasses in there, then you just use a broadleaf herbicide that will kill oxeye sunflower, and you put that in the proper mixture in a little spray can like you would use to spray plants, like a little mister, and then you spray that. Put it, don't take it off of mist and put it onto nozzle so it's straight to stream, and then saturate that cotton glove to just before it starts to drip, and then you stroke the upper half of the oxeye sunflower plant, and that will put the herbicide on the leaves and kill the plant. And so that way you're not having any collateral damage to the adjacent plants. If there's another flower touching it, then you have to push that with your feet to the side. So you're kind of doing a little dance out there. Okay. So that will take a while, but it's way more effective than trying to keep mowing the seed heads off.
Okay. On that happy note, Neil, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it. And look forward to seeing you next time around. Thanks, Neil.
Thank you, Larry. It's always a pleasure to be on your great show.
Neil DeBull, president of Prairie Nursery, and by way of full disclosure, we should mention that Prairie Nursery is one of Wisconsin Public Radio's many business sponsors. It's great to have him with us. Coming up, we're going to take a look at a new invasive weed that we definitely do not want. That next. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Great to have you with us for Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. The UW Extension recently announced that another invasive plant is starting to kind of creep into Wisconsin. And to tell us about this plant, what it looks like, the problems it can cause, and how to stop it, we have Mark Rentz back with us. Mark is a UW Extension weed specialist, professor in the Department of Plant and Agroecosystem Sciences. And he's also a member of the DNR's Wisconsin Invasive Species Council. So as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. You may have some questions about the plant we're talking about or maybe other invasive weeds. Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. Mark Rentz, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hey, Larry, how are you?
I am doing good, and I'm wondering, somebody asked me this. I said I was going to have you on, and they said, well, what does a weed scientist do? I said I would ask Mark that right off the bat.
I love that. I always joke when I introduce myself as a weed scientist. I tell people, you can check that off of your bucket list that you met a weed scientist. So weed scientists study plants that are growing out of place and are causing problems with the objectives of land. So in an ag field, it's pretty easy. Weeds are plants that aren't the crop you're trying to harvest and are reducing yields. But in natural areas, it's quite a bit more complicated. And those are a lot of the areas I work in. A lot of these plants will reduce other plants that are present. They might impact wildlife that are there. And then there's a lot of these other ecosystem services that are impacted, like they can change nutrient cycling, change regeneration of forests. And with this species we'll talk about, they can even change fire frequency or fire intensity. So there's lots of impacts that they can have. So I just study those plants that we don't want there or have negative attributes and try and solve or address those problems.
Well, the problem weed that we're going to start with here is called stilt weed. And I took a look at the article that is up on Extension about it. It is a nasty, nasty plant. Well, tell us about stilt weed.
Yeah, it's actually Japanese stilt grass is what it's called. And it's actually a really interesting invasive plant. It's pretty atypical. So everyone's familiar with the crabgrass and it's growing in our lawns. It's in my lawn and I'm a weed scientist. This is like crabgrass. It's an annual grass, but unlike crabgrass, it can grow in shaded environments and it can grow and produce a lot of biomass that can outcompete native plants in our understories of our woodlands. So this Japanese stilt grass is an annual plant that's growing in shaded areas and can dominate some of these landscapes. That's a short overview of this plant.
So I looked at one of the photos. What's the history of how to get into Wisconsin? Maybe do that first.
Well, it's been in the United States before the Depression. So in the 1917, I believe they think it came into the southern parts, and it's a big problem in the Appalachian Smoky Mountains. It's moved up north. It's very prominent in southern Illinois. But we haven't ever seen it in Wisconsin. And in 2020, we got our first present observation in La Crosse, a forest that the DNR owns in La Crosse, and they're actively eradicating that. And we kind of thought, oh, great, maybe that was just a unique situation. And then just this August, I get information that we have a new observation in a woodlot near Beloit. And so because of this secondary observation, which was quite extensive, we decided to do a really aggressive ad campaign to kind of spread the word that this plant is here and we need to be looking for it. And so that's why I'm here today, and I can share some of the results of our initial efforts. We've found three new populations of this since really trying to promote the presence of this plant, which you might think is bad. But the populations we found were all very small, like 30 square feet, 100 square feet, 500 square feet. The size of the table, if you could see the table we're around. So easy to manage. So we kind of view that as a success because it hasn't started impacting the environment yet.
But it the Beloit situation there, that kind of took over. That was a private kind of a private woodlot, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It's owned by an organization, and when we got first notification of this presence, we went there and observed it. And there's some pretty big patches of it. It's around a 20-acre lot, and it was quite extensive. So clearly, it had been there for probably 5 to 10 years, if not longer. We can't really isolate how it got there, but it's been there for some time. The good news is to our knowledge, it's been isolated to that property. So we're working with DNR to actually eradicate that population. We just started that process.
Oh, and so one in Beloit and one up by La Crosse. You wonder why those spots.
Yeah, and it actually kind of does make some sense to me, but I'm a weed scientist, so I'm crazy, right? So this plant spreads by seed. And so any way that seed can move, and so let's think about how a small annual grass seed can move. Doesn't really move in the wind, but it can get on the back of an animal, and it could move. But the best way that it probably moves is it gets onto a piece of our clothing, soil, and our boots, or most likely equipment that's run through and has mud stuck to it. That equipment moves from one site to another site, and that can transport the infestation. And so that's the likely aspect of these. And then once it gets on a site, then we can have wildlife, flood, other things moving it smaller distances.
So maybe we should talk more about what it looks like.
Yeah, so this is, your listeners are going to love this, is us trying to describe a very difficult to identify plant over the radio. But it is, I like to say it's an 11 out of 10 on identifying it on the scale of difficulty, because for someone who's not a botanist, because it's a grass. But it's a unique looking grass. It has very small leaves that are rather wide, much wider than a typical turf grass weed. And it has a distinct white midrib in the middle of it. And it kind of looks like, a lot of people say it kind of looks like a small miniature bamboo when you look at some of the pictures. So that's not a very good description. I think we have lots of good resources that walk you through on how to identify it. And we have pictures of lookalikes, grasses, as well as broadleafs that can help identify it. It's hard. And so that's why we're recommending, if you see a grass growing in a forested or a partial sun area that has a white midrib, take a picture and send it to us, to DNR, to an expert. Send it to Larry. Larry will send it to me.
Absolutely.
And we'll get it identified and confirmed.
And actually, Jill's reminding me, we have a photo and a link to the article on our program notes. So on the Larry Mueller Show, if you go there, look at today's date, and we'll have a link to the article on our program notes for today's show. That's stripe down the middle is fairly distinctive.
Yeah, yeah, and we have a native Leersia species grass that looks very similar to it, but it does not have that white stripe, and that's really a key thing to be on the lookout for.
If I find that plant on my backyard, what should I do? I've let you know, but can I get rid of it too?
So number one, let us know. It is a prohibited plant in Wisconsin, which means if it's on your property, you're required by law to manage it, or the DNR can come in and manage it themselves or hire someone to manage it and send you the bill. But I will say they're pretty proactive about this, working with land managers. The good news is it's relatively easy to control. It's an annual. So how do we control annuals? Well, we prevent seed production. So that can be done in a wide range of ways and a wide range of approaches. There are approaches very similar to how we manage crabgrass and lawns with pre-emergent herbicides and even some post-emergent herbicides. You can pull it by hand. There's spot burning or even other options. So lots of options available. It's a relatively easy plant to control. It's just growing in areas that are hard to manage in these forests and woodland areas.
Yeah, and once they get going, that one photo in the story, I mean, it just carpeted a whole area.
Right, exactly, and that's what it does. It creates this dense mat of vegetation, and even though it's a grass, near the base on the nodes, it creates additional roots. That's why they call it stilts, stilt grass. And that allows it to kind of like grow like a vine over vegetation, and it just dominates it. You see some of these pictures, and it just looks just really scary from the south. And so we're trying to stop it from getting a foothold in Wisconsin. And that's why we're here today, and we're really trying to promote people be on the lookout for it.
And we'll talk some more about it. We've got a couple of questions relating to other kinds of weeds. Joseph in Green Bay has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Joseph.
Hi. So I live like by a protected woodland in like the Alloway area just outside of Green Bay. I just kind of used Google, where you can use your phone to kind of look at the plant and it tells you what it is.
Yep.
I believe it's an Asian white mulberry.
Mm-hmm.
And it says that they typically get planted because of, you know, a wildlife that goes to wetlands and birds. But is there any way you can prevent that in any way? I mean, I kind of have just some wild, I have some like kind of wild growth in the back. That's not just my mowed lawn. It's like a little bit of a kind of woods wild area. But man, that stuff lately just keeps growing, and I dig them up and they keep coming, and the roots are strong. It keeps coming.
Yeah, so any of these woody plants can be really problematic and difficult because we don't see them until they're big and massive, and then it takes a lot of energy and resources to manage it. Like I just mentioned with stiltgrass, there's a wide range of techniques that are available that are specific to the species. So what you'll hear me say is management is species specific. So go and look up management techniques for this specific species. You can type in the name of the species into Google or go to my website, and we have lots of resources on management. Woody invasives of the Great Lakes. Wiggle is a great resource. It talks about the woody invasives. I would have you double check Google's AI algorithm on identification. Those are good tools that can be used. By our estimations, they're right about 70 to 80% of the time. So it's a pretty good percentage that they're right. But when they're wrong, they can be really, really wrong and lead you astray. Mm-hmm. So maybe snap a picture, send it to me. On my or an expert, and we can confirm identification. Then we can work with you on getting you the right tools to manage. There's definitely options available, though.
Okay. Joseph, there you go. Thanks for calling. David in Madison has a question, too. Hi, David.
Yeah, hi. This is David from Madison. I have porcelain berry in my yard, and I just learned about it, and I'm looking to get rid of it. My neighbors have some of it too. And I guess kind of two questions. First of all, what's the best way to get rid of it? And second, do you have any suggestions for educating my neighbors about the dangers of this new invasive?
Yeah, great question. And for those that live in Madison and nearby, unfortunately, we were one of the spots where it was recommended and widely planted before we realized it is an invasive plant and we shouldn't be planting it. So David, you have some of the previous landowners in Wisconsin to thank for that problem before we got word spread. So it is another woody vine to woody plant, and there are a range of methods that are effective. It really depends on what you're willing to partake. I think this is really a community effort, and so trying to educate your neighbors is really a good idea because you can do your best to manage it, but it's always going to come back from that other side of the fence. Use of herbicides is probably going to be the most efficient method, but that comes with some risks. And so I think really trying to get a better understanding of exactly where it grows before I recommend one specific approach. But there's lots of individual plant treatment methods where you can cut the stem, paint a concentrated herbicide on the surface of the stem, and that can get really good results with minimal to no off-target potential. But if you want to send me an email, I can, again, give you more specific information if you give me more decisions. Mm-hmm. Now, how to educate your neighbors is we have some great resources on invasive plants on our website, and you could maybe just print those out and hand those to the neighbor and say, look, this is an invasive plant. This is bad. This is regulated by the state of Wisconsin. And ask if you can work together to manage it. I think that's the approach. And do it in a positive way, not a negative way, like, you have this, you have to get rid of this, or I'm turning you in. Those almost always end up in bad results. And so try to work proactively. And we have some great resources you could share with your neighbor.
And what's the website that David should go to?
Yeah, it's wrensweedscience@cals.wisc.edu.
And Wrens is R-E-N-Z.
Yeah.
Wrens,
yep.
What is it again?
Wrens Weed Science. So if you just Google Wrens Weed Science, it'll pop up. And then we have a tab that's invasive plant identification. If you go on there, we have over 100 slides of the over 100 invasive regulated species in Wisconsin. That's really useful.
All right. David, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Michelle emailed, she has some pokeweed behind her shed, and she just got a puppy. Is pokeweed toxic to dogs, and how does she safely remove it?
So pokeweed's a really, really interesting story. So pokeweed, we have a native version and then a non-native invasive version. And the story goes that Madison is a hot spot for the invasive version, and someone at the medical hospital planted a bunch of it in Wisconsin and thought they were planting the native and ended up planting the non-native. And that's why we have a bunch of it. So the first thing I would do is try and identify if it's the native or the invasive. We have a lot of the common ones too, and we've got some resources on our website to tell the difference. What I would do is the easiest thing to do is both the native and non-native do have toxic properties. that you do need to be aware of. And probably the best thing to do is just take a shovel at this time of the year and just cut it right below the soil surface. It may resprout, but it'll only grow like an inch or so as we're this close to fall, and then you'll be safe from that. I don't recall if it's the berries that are toxic or if it's actually the leaf material, but I think just cut it, throw away that leaf material in your garbage can, and you should be good to go and safe for your puppies.
Leslie in Cottage Grove emailed, she had to remove an overgrown arborvitae tree from her front walk and was told to put the herbicide Tordon RTU on the stump. Now the adjacent bushes seem to be dying. Did that herbicide, she put it on the stump, but she's wondering, did the herbicide somehow drift from the stump of the arborvitae and is killing the front bushes? Also, her well is about 25 feet from the site where this happened. Mm-hmm. Have they compromised the well?
So, it's likely that Tordon has moved off of that cut surface. It's a very effective way to control woody plants to use this herbicide. But the active ingredient in Tordon RTU is picloram, and that... And what happens is that will be absorbed into the plant and the roots. And after it kills that plant, the roots break down. And as those roots break down, where does that herbicide go? It gets released back into the soil. And so that's what's likely then being taken up by those other plants. I'm seeing the picture. Is that the picture there, Larry?
Yeah, that's the photo.
And that's likely what's causing the damage. There are other herbicides that don't have this persistence that picloram, the active ingredient Tordon RTU, has that should have been used that would have given as good a control. So I think she got some bad advice, to be honest. As far as the groundwater and well water, this can move in the soil. It does not move. It moves to a moderate degree. I'd recommend that she test her soil water just to be safe, but I would bet that there's not going to be a problem there, because even though you applied a concentrated solution to that cut surface, it's still a relatively small amount and has to move down into the well through all that soil. And it does break down in the soil, but test it just to be safe so you can sleep at night.
Mark Renz, our guest, UW-Madison Extension weed scientist. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News and Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest today, Mark Renz, UW-Madison Extension weed scientist. It's great to have him with us. And questions, again, we still have some time. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. And we were talking about stilt grass start the show, but we're taking other weed questions as well as we move along. And you're part of the DNR's Wisconsin Invasive Species Council. What does that council do?
Yeah, so Wisconsin DNR is responsible for regulating invasive species. And I can't remember how many years ago, as a function of that, they wanted to have a council that could help advise DNR on how to regulate this, and they update the regulations. And so I'm one member of about 10 or 15 that are on this council. And as they update our invasive species rule, NR40, our prime efforts are to bring in other opinions and make sure that they're conducting it with the best science and giving recommendations on how they move forward with that rule. We're currently under a revision right now, so we just had a meeting this week where we've been discussing updates to what the invasive species rule. Currently, we regulate over 100, I believe 130, just plants alone. So it's a very large list, very complicated. And that's being updated because, unlike we think, the reality is plants don't stay the same. They change over time and they move. And so we need to update the rules as invasions get worse, or in very few instances do get better. For the most case, they just get worse. And so how bad do they get?
Dave in Fitchburg, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Larry. Great show, like always. Hey, I have a question that I'm sure if you guys don't know, listeners can. there's there's a weed that creeps up all like pine trees and things along 39, actually just south of Plover, you know, between those tree lines that break up the potato fields.
Yep.
And
I know exactly.
A little triangle. It's just, and it's a light green, you know, kind of fluorescent green kind of color. What is that?
So we have two, it could be one of two species. It could either be wild cucumber or burr cucumber. And believe it or not, even though those look invasive and like really, really impactful, those are both native plants to Wisconsin. That it's an annual vine that grows from seed every year. They're related to cucumbers, and they come up and look horrible at this time of the year. But then, you know, in a month, they'll all be dead from the frost and the trees look fine. So we get one to two calls every year saying, oh, we got to manage this invasive plant. And it's just a weed. It's just a plant that we don't want growing there. We don't even really think it really impacts those trees that it grows on because it doesn't become prolific until now. But boy, does it sure look bad right now at this time. I can attest to that. Drive by it all the time.
Thanks, Dave. Appreciate the call. And Diane in Ashland, your turn. Hi, Diane.
Hi, how are you today, Larry? Good. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing. What can we do for you?
I have an issue with milkweed in my field that I grazed my sheep and goats, and I have just found out that milkweed is toxic to those animals, and I'm wondering how I can get rid of that because it's spreading.
Right. So milkweed is a native plant, very beneficial to monarchs, but it does have toxic principles. Is it the broadleaf milkweed that has a very broad leaf that's several inches in diameter and like maybe 6 or 8 inches long? Or is it one that has very narrow leaves?
I don't think they're that big. Well, they could get that big when the plant is higher. It can grow, you know, 2 to 3 feet high with real wide leaves and big pods, about 3 to 4 inches.
Yep. So that sounds like it's the broadleaf milkweed. That the good news with that one is that's one of the least poisonous milkweeds of all of the ones that we have. So that's the good news. The bad news is it's very difficult to manage if you want to eliminate it. So I think the first thing I would do is if you know this, please let me know. But I would go out and evaluate, are your animals actually eating it? Because what we find is milkweed is highly unpalatable to almost all livestock, and they just avoid it. So even though it's unsightly and it's spreading, you may not need to manage it if they're not chewing or nibbling on the leaves. Do you have any indication that they're feeding on it?
No, I don't know that for sure, but that's a really good point, just to go out and see if they are actually eating it.
Because the other options are going to be to do intensive mowing, spraying lots of herbicides, and to be honest, neither of those work very well. You might just reduce a population by like 50 to 60% and spend a bunch of time and money. So I would start there and see if they're feeding on it. And if they are, then maybe send me an email or get back in touch with me and we can talk about some other options. If they're not, I would just keep a close eye on that and you're likely okay. It's in a lot of our pastures in Wisconsin.
All right. There you go, Diane. Thank you so much. And here we are out of time. Mark, what's your address again, the Wrens at?
So my website is wrensweedscience@cals.wisc.edu. Or you can always send me an email at mrenz@wisc.edu.
Always a pleasure, Mark. Boy, the time flew. Thanks so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. And we'll get you back and we'll do this again.
Thanks. You bet. Love it, Larry. Take care.
And thank you for joining us today. And thanks to our producers, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnaud, our technical directors, Jeff Robbins on the board today, and Lee Rayburn. Our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller, and thank you for listening, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.